Tell me when you're ready.
Okay, we're ready.
Hey, this is Donovan Bailey here with the other Donovan, Donovan Bennett. Let's go.
I'm going to put that in my bio, the other Donovan.
The Donovan.
I'm going deep. I feel like Halo on the Miami Heat. The words I speak off this sheet are like a three-peat. I don't just hop on a track, I bring running cleats. I'm a player for real, more than an athlete. Let my mama tell it, could have ran for the Senate. Instead, I penned it for Donovan Bennett. I'm cemented, this a deep dive. In your headphones or a long drive. Up close and personal, just like you courtside. There ain't no out of bounds here, no offsides. We going live in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. You are now tuned in to Going Deep with Donovan Bennett.
Thanks so much, Capital, and we go deep on a couple really talented Canadians who became champions in sports that traditionally you don't think Canadians dominate in. Certainly, we've had great success in track and field, whether it's multidisciplinary competitions with Pierce Lepage or Damian Warner, who both have come on the podcast. Go through your podcast feed to listen to those. Or in sprinting, thanks to Andre DeGrasse. Also, go through your podcast feed for a conversation with him. But the man who really set it off, specifically in short distance track and field in Canada, is Donovan Bailey, man who shares my name and someone who inspired me as a kid. Well, he's continuing to inspire others because he's given back to the sport, also had real success in the business sector. Well, he's now having success as an author, and his book, Undisputed, talks about the life lessons both from his childhood upbringing, immigrating to Canada from Jamaica, like my family, or his success joining track and field late in his career, really his prime, which is in his 30s, which is antithetical for a track star, and everything that he's done afterwards. The book is undisputed, his legacy is undisputed, and we catch up with him right now. I'm going deep.
So many accolades on your Wikipedia. Now, author, why now? Why was this the right time to tell your story via this platform?
You know what? First of all, thanks for having me. There's been many things written. There's been many things written over the years, and you know, I'm still very fortunate to be relevant. I think there were conversations that I was having as an athlete that the world wasn't ready for then. And so I was probably, you know, judged, you know, at that time as whether or not the words were arrogant or overconfident or American or Jamaican Canadian, you know, and so the conversations, the world probably wasn't ready to have the conversations that I want to have then. So, you know, as far as my athletic prowess, I'm still the greatest sprinter to ever put on a Canadian uniform. And so with that, it's 2023, and the world's also having a conversation about a lot of things that I went through in life. You know, so I just think, why not? It's definitely the right time. I'm still the champ. I'm still the greatest to put on the uniform here. I'm still the only man with world records, gold medals, and world championships. You know, so why not? Why not now?
You know what this process is like. Often these books, when they're written by the subject, mm-hmm. bit of an infomercial. There's nothing really interesting in the story.
Right.
You're pretty honest.
Right.
You're pretty vulnerable. Why did you feel comfortable enough to be so direct in the right. book?
You know what? I've always preached about being my authentic self. You know, so I think I'd be a hypocrite if I wrote a book and not like put it all out there, you know? So, and there's probably more to go out there. I don't know if everyone's ready for everything, but definitely it's in this book where I can be vulnerable and I can speak about life. I can speak about the amazing upbringing that I have, the relationship I had with my mother, you know, as a mama's boy, the great relationship I had with my father, which I think that we don't speak about that enough as black men. I don't think that if I'm gonna go there, I don't think that we speak about that enough, how important it is for the relationship between a boy and his dad and a boy and his mom. And so this book is, this book hopefully kind of puts it all out there. So, you know, maybe I can go run for politics now.
I'd love to see it.
I don't know about that.
You talk about the relationship with your parents, and you also talk about your relationship as a parent.
Right.
And the book is dedicated to your parents.
And my kids.
And your kids.
Right.
We don't often in mass media see that relationship from either side of black men. Are you cognizant of the fact that you have the ability to shed a different light on what that relationship looks like?
DJ, I've always been a trailblazer, man, you know, and I think ultimately I was never thinking about what it is I was gonna, when I started this process, I didn't know what I was setting out to do. But I think that it's important culturally, you know, the relationship I had with my mom and dad, and also the evolution of what it is that I am, who it is that I am as a man, and who I am as a person and a parent, to kind of share all that, because the world is changing and we have things are happening every single day. There's things that are happening every single day. There's changes made, and I think that we as humans all have to evolve to adjust to whatever it is that's happening.
There's a conversation we're still having. You look at someone like Deion Sanders about the world's ability to handle a black man that is both successful and outspoken.
Right.
You dealt with that in the 90s.
Right.
The fact that we're still having this conversation makes you feel what?
Old. but imagine that. You just mentioned Deion, who is, you know, an amazing inspiration as an athlete, as a father, as a partner, as a coach, as a motivational speaker, you know, as a positive role model, like, across the board. I mean, he happens to be a black man, yes, but he's such an incredible force, right? And so I had to deal with that as an athlete. And funny, we're having a conversation now. I'm still dealing with that now, still being a positive person, you know, amidst all the nuances and the craziness that I've gone through with relationships with our sports association and governing bodies and all that, especially in this country. This nothing's gonna stop me. And I think that a big part of my book is to just kind of put it out there to a lot of the younger kids that are out there, that there's going to be issues, there's going to be bumps in the road, but who cares? Ignore it, march on.
You mentioned the friction that you've had repeatedly with the infrastructure in Canada. I went through your story and oftentimes thought to myself this would have gone differently if Donovan was American.
Oh, God, yes. Yes.
How so?
Well, yeah, because they embrace positivity. They embrace confidence, and they embrace and love winners. I mean, I think that a lot of times we have conversations. I've had conversations before where some of our great Canadian reporters are saying how I'm American. I'm like, you're saying that I work really hard, positive. I want to win. I speak it into existence. I surround myself with really good people. I mean, if that makes me anything other than I'm a winner, I think. If that makes me something else, then you're the one with the problem and not me.
It's funny because when you look at that dynamic, so many Canadians embraced you for your willingness to take on Americans.
Correct. Right. Well, I mean, yes. I mean, you know what, Donovan, I am. There are so many times that especially Canadian fans, when they're saying to me, by the way, the World Championships, awesome, that's great. The Olympics, being the fastest man in the history of the world, fantastic. He goes, but you know when I really felt like a Canadian and I felt that enough was enough? Was the 150 versus Michael at the Sky Dome. Because for once, I think I felt I could go to work. I could be a better employee. I speak to a lot of athletes who kind of go, oh my God, you know what? I felt then I could go on and be a great water polo player or hockey player or basketball player, baseball player, a track athlete. I speak to journalists, musicians. They're like, yo, dude, listen, that time, man, yeah, you let them have it. And by the way, the whole thing, the whole interview at the end, yes, that's stayed with me and I play that for my kids.
Is it because us as Canadians, we have sometimes an inferiority complex where you can't just be the best in the world? You have to be better than the people south of us first.
Right. Right. Maybe. I think that the issue for me was this, that I came from a great place. I came from a great place where I had you know, the best people that were cheering me on every day. Those very same people, if they're alive today, they're still cheering me on. And if they're not alive, believe me, guardian angels are around. And I think that as Canadians, sometimes, you know, there's this, I mean, I don't know if there's this role that you should take on, that even if you are the best, you should gently walk in. And that's not how the world works. I mean, you know, I embraced winning and maybe again, leaving Oakville and moving to the Southern United States, where I was in a hotbed of sports, where, you know, I was in, when I left Oakville and I went to Collegetown, USA, which is Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and you kind of go, man, there's tailgating parties that these guys start 1 week before the home game. And I never saw that before. I mean, and you talk about rabid fans who, I mean, they live their life from the parking lot of the stadium. They left from there, go to their work, whatever their work is, and came right back. They didn't even go home. You know, so I saw that, and I also embraced that. I think that even there are times, actually, that I've been in Canada, I'm like, I've actually forgotten. You know, that's why I've forgotten who I am. You know, like, whether it's my confidence or my ability to be fearless or to be limitless. I mean, so for me, I will always continue to push that. I mean, thank God I have a platform still that I can tell people, man, go be you, go do you. I mean, I've said it to you.
You have many times. I think it actually starts even before then.
Right.
How you came to this country, where you came to this country from, and the age that you came to this country, not unique to you. I see it in many immigrants at that stage, where you came from a place where everybody looked like you.
Right.
Walk me through why that upbringing and that dynamic changed what you felt was possible for yourself, even when you came to Canada.
Well, a couple of things. If you come to my family reunion, and I'd say this to people about Jamaica all the time, if you come to my family reunion, you might be shocked to kind of see all the people that are connected through the Bailey DNA. I mean, on one spectrum, it might look like a guy from Norway. On the other side, it might be, you know, East Indian, and then black guy or Asian. You know, so my family dynamic is huge. And, you know, my mom is East Indian and black. My dad was Asian, black, and Scottish. So I was very comfortable in my environment growing up. I might look like this, but I was very uncomfortable, I was very comfortable in my environment growing up. So me moving to Canada, growing up in Oakville, oh yeah, I mean, there was no room that I could walk in that I ever considered myself lesser than. And I think a part of the book was maybe when I started competing for Canada, I felt that some of the officials thought that I should feel that I'm lesser than, which is a different kind of thing, because that would be just, for me, it would be pouring gasoline on who I really am inside, which is fearless towards dealing with any single thing that was in front of me. So I was, you know, DJ, I was always very comfortable with myself. And again, that's, again, because of my parents, and again, because of my upbringing and my confidence and their ability to prepare me for what the world was supposed to be, or what the world could bring, and how I needed to deal with it. But I was always, dude, I've never ever walked into a room and felt that I didn't belong there.
You've walked in many different types of rooms. You put your business career on pause to really chase your track dreams, and you talk about Bailey Inc. in the book. That business career has continued after your athletic career. When you walk in here through security, where you're dressed, people don't know if you're meeting with the Board of Governors or a broadcaster like me. Why was it important to show that side of yourself and that side of the accomplishments that you've had?
Well, I think sometimes it's incredible when people are trying to shove you in a little box. And I think that when I speak to people about going to track and field, you know, I guess the model or the basic understanding is that there are for sports is that especially as a black man, they think that you're coming from your lower social economic background. This is your way out. And I want to tell my story, because actually my story is very much like everybody else's. you know, what you have. You grew up in a middle class community. You've got mom and dad, and they expect you to do really well in school. I mean, I like sports too. Really good in school. Go off to university, get a degree, end up on Bay Street or be a doctor, lawyer, you know, whatever, business person. So all of that was just important for me. I want to share all of the things that I do and all the things that I do enjoy. Business was something that I loved before sports. Sports was something that I loved while I was doing it. I still enjoy business and sport and philanthropy and being a parent and all of those things today. So I think that the issue that we have sometimes is that people want to shove you in a box, and I don't belong in a box at all. And so I always encourage people that they should explore every single thing within them that's going to allow them to be balanced and successful.
There's a box that you're in that you do belong to be in. During Black History Month, I'll go to schools, and it's interesting to see the different figures that are celebrated and taught, but there's a couple that, no matter where, are on that list. Viola Desmond, Willie O'Ree, Donovan Bailey.
Wow.
For you to be a teaching point on the history of Black Canadians, when for so long our Black history was learning about Americans, what does that mean for you?
Well, first of all, that's an incredible list, and I'm very humbled to be part of that list. That's number one. Number two, you know what? I'm just George and Daisy's son. That's really how I look at it. I made some opportunities for myself. I was given some opportunities. I had great support, and I just took advantage of all those things. Now, if playing it forward, I've set the standards. That's pretty high, and we can teach that not only during Black History Month, but the other 11 months, then I'm happy. I'm happy that I did those things. And now, when I was an athlete, there was really no blueprint for me to be successful either during my career or post-career. So I'm hoping that my story will be instrumental in anyone really in Canada who want to be the very best. And so they can speak into that being their truths, and then they can get up and go work at it.
Other through line in your story is, no matter what, uber competitive.
Really?
I imagine that just doesn't go away. Do you miss it? Going through and retelling these stories, did it give you an itch?
You know what? I'm a competitor, regardless, right? I'm a competitor. But there's times I realize you just can't keep it. I remember competition days where it was drink at the end of the day. I'll start at the end of the day. At the end of the day, I'm just exhausted. You want to go to sleep. But at the start of the day, there's nothing like it. There's absolutely nothing like it. I mean, you know, I've never taken drugs, so I don't really understand how it changes people. But I know this. Adrenaline is one of those things that I can never like forget. Like on competition day, I'm like, oh, today's the day. So because you're living it, breathing it every single day, you wake up in the morning, like, all right, somebody's about to get crushed today, man. This is gonna be nice, right? So and I always wanted to find something to be mad at or something to target. I don't know. Adrenaline is great. Competition, it gets tiring now, DJ. I'm an old man. It gets tiring now. But I don't understand any other way. I only operate on one gear. So even now, I mean, you know, we're here. I'm doing the book tour promo. So I'm up. I'm like, oh man, let's go. Let's go at it. You know, I'll end up playing golf in the weekend, or the fellas and I are gonna play poker. Yeah, that switch comes on a little bit. You know, it gets there and it comes on. But yeah, it's not clearly not at the intensity level that it was when I was actually, on my field of play.
If we took Donovan from the era in the 90s, mm-hmm. and placed him in today's era as a current athlete, how would things be different? Pro, con, what would that experience be like?
Okay, so I actually don't like to compare, right? I don't like to compare because I think that the person who best suits that question would probably be my coach, Dan. Because when we have conversations, I mean, Dan has been always good at giving me a big head, but also could take that away very quickly, right? So with the technology that exists in the world right now, with the track, training, nutrition, physical support, media support, I think that I would be different. But I can't tell you that I wouldn't be anything other than like the greatest sprint on earth if I was competing today.
Twitter or X now,
right?
Social media is a difference. If you at your height had the access to the world via a phone,
right,
I know it would be great for me as a content creator. Would that have been good?
Well, again, several times I have conversations with my good friends now, some of them in the media, some of them, you know, who are big social media guys, because they're like, oh, Don, why are you not on social media all the time? We know you. And I'm like, I know that if social media existed when I was competing, I'd probably have about 200 million followers, man. I mean, because every single day was fun. And it was fun for me. And it really was, I don't know if I was trying to create content. I think maybe I was just the content.
This book, in a way, is a bit of a TED Talk. If you gave your story to someone and there was a lesson of value that you hoped they took away from it and applied to their life, what would it be?
Wow. Well, like my mom said, sometimes it's not your time. Surround yourselves with the right people and be patient.
Easier said than done.
Well, you have to be disciplined to be all of those things, which simply means that you have to make a commitment to yourself first, right? And I think that's the world we live in right now, where you have a lot of people that are looking at the material gain of other people on social media and not understanding the value of a team and the work that you have to put in.
Lastly, I know you're meticulous and you're looking at the entire chessboard.
Right.
So what's next? And your story is not done. What are the next chapters of the influence that you want to have?
God, man. Well, I would like this book to be a bestseller. Maybe another book or two. You know what? But I'm going to continue to utilize my platform. I'm going to continue to play forward. I'm going to continue to motivate and inspire people, you know, far and wide, anywhere around the globe. I don't know. I mean, there's always been talk of politics. I don't know if I'm ready for that. Or better yet, I don't know if they'll be ready for me. I want to continue to be an inspirational person, because I think that that is what my legacy should be.
Many people around the world will look at this book, but certainly Canadians will have a different and special relationship with it, as they have with you. Some people are going to be learning about your story.
Hope so.
For the first time.
Hope so.
For Canadians specifically, what do you want them to know about your relationship with the country and with them?
Well, one, I think the book, it's not necessarily a call out, but I wanted people to understand that regardless of the relationship I had with specific people in specific organizations, that never stopped me from being the greatest Canadian there was. That never stopped me from loving and embracing the fact that I was serenaded by the national anthem wherever I go around the world. And also to thank the Canadian fans, because every single day, from the day that I was competing until 2 seconds ago walking in here, I get the love and I feel the love. You know, so I just wanted that balance to be. I mean, I think the Canadian fans are gonna learn a little bit about what happened. And hopefully some of those people that kind of were in the way, kind of understood that, one, I do collect data, I'm probably the wrong person to mess with, because I'm going to come back and have a conversation with you at some point. I am not a victim. I don't feel bitter at all. It's just my story.
Well, I love the fact that you kept receipts over time. Many of them are in this book, but I also love that there's a real lesson in that the only opinion that really matters is the one you have of yourself. And you're able to do great things because of that high opinion. So thank you. And thank you for sharing those lessons with me personally and now with all of us publicly in the book.
Well, thank you for having me again, man, and keep doing your good work.
Thanks so much to Donovan Bailey, history-making Olympian, recipient of the Order of Canada, and now, with his first memoir, an author. Undisputed, A Champion's Life is available wherever you get your books, and I've read it, and it is a good read. Speaking of which, we are going to talk to another champion and another author after the break.
My name is Lucille Bryan.
I'm Clifton Bryan.
My grandson has a show.
And I'm so happy that you're listening to Going Deep with Donovan Bennett.
I'm so glad that he had a show. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Grandma and Granddad. We are focusing on champions here on Going Deep in this episode, and one that you might not know, but you should get to know her story, is world champion climber Sasha Jejulian. Now, climbing is traditionally a male-dominated sport, but she has really dominated it from a young age. She won her first national sport climbing championship at only 17 years old. Later, just a year after that, she took home a world championship. She's now also not just an athlete, but also a business mogul and a graduate from Columbia University. When you look at the fact she's also an environmentalist, an entrepreneur, and an author, she's got a real interesting story, one that she tells in her book, Take the Lead. And so while she was back in Canada talking about that new book and upcoming business ventures, I caught up with Sasha to find out, how does a young six-year-old decide that she wants to go into climbing and make that a career? Sasha, take me back to before the beginning, before you started climbing. How did, as a young kid, climbing even present itself as a potential athletic option for you?
That's a great question, because it didn't. I didn't even know that climbing was a sport, to be quite honest. And my family is both Canadian. I grew up in the US and I dabbled in a lot of different sports, namely ballet, figure skating, soccer team, swim team. And I've been skiing since I was 3 up at Mont Tremblant. And my brother had a birthday party at a local climbing gym in 1999. He's a year older than me. And I went to the birthday party. It was like me and his hockey friends and his school friends. And I was ruthlessly competitive with my brother, and I was better than him at something. So that was encouraging. And then also, honestly, like, it just felt natural to me. I wasn't scared. I wasn't, unwilling to go up the wall. I wanted to keep climbing and climbing and climbing. So the employee working the birthday party told my mom, your daughter has an inkling for climbing, which maybe they say to every kid's parent at the birthday party, but it stuck to me. I went and I joined their junior team program, which was meeting each Wednesday and Saturday. And then on a Saturday morning, I showed up to junior team practice. The gym was closed because there was a youth regional championship taking place. So I literally was 7 years old, stumbling upon this whole world of competitive climbing. I didn't even know that there was a competition circuit or anything like that. I competed in my category, which was 11 and under, and I won my category. And that was kind of the first of, what would then be a decade and a half of competitions around the world and competing for the US team, winning championship, overall world championship title in Pan Ams and Nationals. So that was the start. That was my exposure to climbing.
And then how do you go from climbing indoors, which is 1 foot, to climbing outdoors, which, you know, has another layer of challenge, but also, you know, as a viewer anyways, mystique?
Yeah, I started dabbling in outdoor climbing when I was probably 9 was the first time that my junior team took a trip to this place called the New River Gorge, which was in West Virginia and about 4 hours from where I grew up in the DC metro area. And it was very like organized event where it would basically be like going with like Boy Scouts or something like that. Like we just went climbing, and I was like, wow, this is really fun. Like you have this whole creative canvas where you're climbing on rock. But it never really occurred to me to make this big transition, because indoor climbing and competition climbing is on plastic surfaces. But then as I grew up within my scope of competition climbing and doing better at that, I kind of just got exposure to the fact that a huge component of the sport takes place in the outdoors. And that's like where the sport originated. And also where you can set these limitless dreams, because there's rocks all around the world. But it was like that initial going with my junior team to go to local areas climbing together, then meeting friends who are other climbers, going outside to places in like Europe and Spain and stuff like that. When I was 16 years old, on a Christmas break, I remember I had met some friends through the World Cup, the Junior World Cup circuit, and I met up with them in Barcelona, and we rented a car and we went out to these cliffs, which are like very well documented, and you can get a guidebook in an area, and if you have the right equipment and knowledge of how to use that equipment. So I always say to newcomers to the sport, like hire a guide. There's so many guide services. Or go with a friend who actually knows what they're doing, because climbing is inherently like a dangerous sport. If you don't know how to use the equipment and what you're doing, things can turn the wrong way quickly. But I just had friends, and it was like this snowball effect of like going and having one experience, then having another, learning a little bit along the way and having more experiences like that.
No matter if we're talking indoor or outdoor, recreational or competitive, I'm assuming that it is a pretty male-dominated space. How did you manage and navigate that while keeping your, you know, female identity and female sensibility with everything you're doing?
It is a male-dominated sport, especially within the roots of the sport. Now there are so many more women getting involved, which is really exciting, because I do think that it's one of those sports that the delta between what men are capable of and what female women are capable of is actually so small. Because if it's to be, it's up to your body and you working with your body to scale the wall. But I've experienced a lot of pushback on my career just for being a woman, frankly, and for being feminine and taking the sport to a more mainstream level. Like I've been working with more mainstream companies like Red Bull and Adidas. And I've done work with, you know, more luxury brands in the automotive and makeup space and stuff like that, which is it cuts against the grain of what the tradition within climbing even is, because there's a very core contingency of climbing that is almost gatekeeper-esque, like not wanting the sport to expand because that means less open air freedom maybe to the people who want to go and not see people while they're climbing and are scared of this sport becoming more popular. But I've always come at it as, you know, I have these like amazing experiences, and I've been able to really find myself, to your point of like owning my own femininity and realizing like it doesn't have to be mutually exclusive. Like I can be an authentic athletic athlete in a sport and also dress however I want, paint my nails however I want, wear makeup if I want. And so that angle, I think it's just we don't need to hold the sport back.
How does that pushback manifest itself? Is there a particular scenario or anecdote that you think of when you think of the pushback in totality that you've faced?
Yeah, I would say that the most salient point that I would say that female climbers in general experience is climbing outside is scored on a grading scale. And by nature of it, it's a pretty biased, you know, subjective grade scale because we have 5.0 to 5.15. And after 5.10 breaks into subcategories of A, B, C, and D. And that number, which probably means absolutely nothing to a lot of you guys listening, means like the angle of the wall, like how upside down you are, how long you'll be climbing, what's the endurance that your forearms are getting fatigued over through holding on by your fingertips to these like tiny dime-sized edges while, you know, moving up a cliff face. And then the quality of the holds involved, like what sort of protrusions you can find on the rock, where your body placement will be, will all contribute to this overall grade that like I could do something totally cutting edge and tack on like, you know, this is 514C. And that to me feels appropriate, whatever it is. But then three people could come and agree with that grade. Then the first person who says, no, it's actually 514B, the entire system is shook and it goes down to 514B. So that's a little bit of a, like a very nuanced part of climbing. But what I will say with where it transfers is in achievements within climbing, a woman may do something really hard, like a 514D. And when it's reported by men about it, you know, maybe they'll say, oh, I think it's soft. I think it's more like 514C. But if a male does it, you know, it's going to hold that grade of 514D. So I think that that's one instance, which is probably sounds very particular, but in a sport that's led by particulars and led by nuances, the scorecard constantly changing if you're a male or if you're a female does matter. And just the reception in general, like I think that we live in a world today that's very connected, but also very disconnected. And at the dawn of my career, really starting to grow a lot was when I was a teenager. And that was the really like paralleling the dawn of social media. And with that came the introduction of trolls and people commenting on what I looked like, what I was wearing, even who I was dating, the validity of my career and accolades. There's been a lot of underscoring of my achievements and it crushes me, honestly. Like it gets me super down. And then what lifts me up is the people around me and my support network. And like, when I'm having these real life interactions with people and knowing that how hard I worked and what I did achieve and that this like baseless rumor nonsense is just that, that is how I get through it. But I think that words online can be really powerful and negative too. It's just, learning ways in which you don't hear the fracas and you rise above it.
You talked about the physicality of the sport. What's the mental toll of the sport, both in terms of, you know, dealing with injury, but also dealing with what you have to ask your body to do and the way you have to literally create your body to be able to move up the side of a mountain?
The mental game is everything in climbing. Like surely, like with any sport, there's a lot of hard work that happens, like doing a lot of training in the gym and cross training and sport specific training. But if your mind's not there, then you can't do anything, because I am, at least for me, like if I have a healthy mindset where I've been doing a lot of breath work control so that when I'm nervous in situations, I can calm my mind down. That's super significant because it's going to affect my heart rate and it's going to affect my ability to physically perform on the climb. But also fear can be so inhibiting. And so I still do experience moments where I'm so terrified. And that actually does translate to a lack of performance. And I'll get terrified through rational situations and terrified through irrational situations where actually the consequences aren't bad at all. Like in climbing, contrary to what some assumptions may be, we fall all the time. Like I'm climbing, what I do is free climbing on big walls, and free climbing is climbing with the use of your hands and your feet with a rope only for protection, not for assistance. And so I'm using my gear to establish new points on the wall as I go. And if I fall, I have essentially, maybe it's a 20-foot, 30-foot fall beneath me into the rope. And those falls are generally pretty safe, but you can also come across territory where they're not so safe. Like you could be looking at a ledge below you and you don't want to fall into a ledge or come hot into the wall where you're like slammed into the rock face from above with momentum. So understanding the physics of both my gear, the angles on the wall, what my fall potential could be, but then alleviating that out of my mindset so that when I'm climbing, I'm purely focused on the exact movement in front of me and what I need to do to be able to send, which is essentially get to the top without falling. So there's a lot of kind of preparation that I'll do beforehand, including visualization and with breath work. If it's a climb that I've never done before, then I think it's just the practice and exposure that I garner over the years of experience that I can apply.
Post the documentary Free Solo, I feel like all of my feeds has been inundated with climbing content, and there's much greater conversation about it. Now, that just could be the algorithm playing tricks on me, but you are in the sport. Have you noticed greater awareness and appreciation for the sport over the last couple of years?
Absolutely. The sport's really grown, honestly, in the last decade, maybe more. Since around 2000, 2010 was when we initially started seeing that spike. And I think that a lot has to do with the commercialization of gyms. Climbing gyms are popping up in urban locations around the world, and they're serving as alternative fitness studios. Like climbing is a really great full body workout that happens to be very social as well. So you can go to the gym with your friend and participate in this sport, and it's very safe and controlled in the gyms, and build community too. It's like you meet people through climbing. I think that that aspect has definitely grown the sport in its popularity, as well as having films come out about the sport and showing. I think that the outdoor side is the aspirational side. There are some statistics in the US that are like 8 in 10 people actually climb, don't even necessarily go outdoor climbing. And I think that that's because the fitness side is what's really growing. And then the outdoor side is more of a steady growth of participation. And I think that there's just this bridge that needs to happen between indoor and outdoor, which is where like knowledge of what you're doing does really matter, because there's no gym employee to tell you that you're regulating safety or, you know, not doing things to safety standards. But it's been really fun to be a part of the growth. I've been climbing since I was 6 years old. And when I went to my high school, or when I went to my middle school, I was like the only kid that climbed, and constantly explaining, you know, what climbing was and feeling like an other. So I always felt almost like an other in my sport, and also an other in real life. And now that more people are aware of it. I just think that it's an amazing sport to learn about your body, to know about balance and discipline and have personal goal setting techniques that are involved in climbing harder and harder and harder, which is again, like all up to you. So that spike in climbing has been, in my opinion, really, really positive for the sport.
When those gyms first started popping up in urban centers, I'm sure those investing in them didn't think they'd potentially be the venue for a book launch, but that was the case for you here in Toronto. Part of that popularity and success means that people are coming to you to write about your story within the sport and beyond. And so your book titled Take the Lead, Hanging On, Letting Go, and Conquering Life's Hardest Climbs. People often ask authors about like, oh, the cover, or the photo. Like, I'm interested in the title because I feel like that can lead to greater understanding. Why the title, and what were you looking to convey, not only in the title, but also over the body of work of the book and what you were hoping to leave readers with at the end?
Take the Lead was my working title for a long time. I wanted to write a book. And at the point that I decided to, it was because one chapter was closing and I felt like I was at this inflection point in my career. And Take the Lead is a term within climbing when there's two climbing partners and you're looking at this big cliff ahead of you. And you say, who wants to take the lead? Who wants to go first? And in the last year, I've also launched a business. And on meetings, I'll say, who wants to take the lead on this initiative, or who wants to take the lead in driving this topic? So it really felt like a very universal term that applies to my everyday in literally every aspect. And I wrote the book to really appeal to both people who love climbing and want to know the nitty-gritty details of my expeditions and the backstories behind these photos that I post on Instagram. But then I also wrote it for people who've never climbed before, because I wanted it to be an open space that could be covering themes that are very universal as well. I think that climbing in its cheesiest form is a metaphor of life. But there was a lot of crossover that I included in my book that was the experience of being an adolescent female growing up and developing a career in a male-dominated sport, and also brand building and what I went through to be able to pay for my tuition at Columbia University while making a living from professional climbing. Which was very unusual, and climbing wasn't traditionally a sport that you made money from. So there was a lot of crossover of maybe I'm hanging and sleeping on the side of a cliff on a portal edge in Madagascar, and I have malaria, and I'm talking about like how you go to the bathroom on the wall with malaria and while trying to do this like big record-breaking ascent. So I wanted it to be understandable for people that are used to climbing and also not used to climbing, and Take the Lead for me is just one of those universal expressions.
Got it. Yeah, I don't know how many people can relate to having to figure out how to go to the washroom with malaria on the side of a mountain. So you mentioned about starting a business, and as much as you can do tandem climbs and be part of a group, in a sense, it is somewhat of an individual sport. There's a relationship between you and the wall or the mountain. Leading a business, there's a relationship with you and your employees, there's a relationship with you and, you know, other businesses you might interact with, and a relationship with you and the theoretical customer. What goals do you have in the business world, and how do you have to lead in a different way in that space?
Leading a business, I'm the founder and CEO of a nutrition bar company called Send Bars. We launched it a year ago, and we're just in the US right now, but really excited to enter in Canada, all real food and superfood ingredients. And I would relate it a lot to creating an expedition team, because you're putting together these different people that fill out each other's voids and also strengthen the overall unit. And you have the same mission, which is to succeed. What's different and where it starts to branch out on an expedition is there's also such an individual component to your own athletic performance on that cliff face, and whether you, the individual, are going to succeed with the support or at tandem with your climbing partners. But in business, much like in planning for an expedition, you're planning out your risk variables, you're figuring out how to mitigate what is risky, what chance you're going to take, how you're going to plan for the overall summit by way of very broken up, small, super minutia details, because all of those matter. You're analyzing what different factors are going on in weather patterns while on an expedition, while in a business. Obviously, the weather doesn't matter so much. And all of these different elements that kind of relate over to the business space. And so what I think is pretty incredible about sports and just youth development in general is that they teach us such an amazing balance and such amazing transformative life skills that we can then apply to any different facet of life in general. But with my business, what's been really fun is climbing while on an expedition does have elements of team. With a business, it really, really is a team sport. I'm working with my colleagues who are also my really close friends. And when one of us succeeds, the entirety of all of us succeeds. And so rooting for each other is similar in the way that in climbing, like, we're friends, we're also sometimes competing against each other. And like, my good friends are also professional climbers. And so there's just an innate element of individuality to it that I would say in business, what I've really enjoyed is being able to really share this like genuine team camaraderie that I can only relate the most to while being on an expedition, living with a team of people with a shared mission of doing something really amazing.
You mentioned the word share, and I think of it when I think of your book, because you were very open and willing to share about your personal life and struggles. You tackle dealing with body dysmorphia. You talk about, you know, what a potential career-ending injury, you know, does to someone. Why were those areas you were willing to go down in this book?
I feel like I'm writing this book. I have this moment that I can really own my own narrative and tell my own story and not have other people telling it for me by way of their own assumptions of who I am. And I want to fully embrace this opportunity and give my readers the full story and all of the details, all of the vulnerable, really challenging details to write about, because they all matter. Like, the details are what were the connective fibers that make the patterns of who I am and how I respond to situations now and how I operate. And there were moments that were really hard to go and write about because it was like revisiting big trauma and confronting it head on. Writing in that process, I had times where I felt like super rattled through the writing process because I was going back and living this situation that I had put a Band-Aid over and moved on. I used to be, I had to be super just go, go, go. Don't think about it too much. Just keep moving. And so when you take the time to go back and like really deeply reflect on difficult moments while also reflecting, I have a lot of positive moments too, but you don't see the triumph if you don't see the struggle, and you don't feel that moment of absolute like ecstatic joy if you don't have that experience of absolute deep low.
And lastly, something that you probably know all too well, is you clearly right now live in the United States, train in the United States, but if you have any Canadian in you, we're going to claim you as a country. You could be here for a day or a lifetime. With this book, what would you want Canadians who, you know, look up to you, inspired by you, proud of you, what would you want them to know from your story that maybe they could apply to their own?
I would love to have the book leave you with a sense of it's okay to not fully know where your passion is going to lead you, but just do it and take part in it and do what you love to do. Pursue that unknown aspect of maybe it's a side hobby, maybe it's a side hustle, maybe it's a sport that you've never tried or a trip that you've never taken. I didn't know what my path looked like when I got started climbing. I had no idea that I would be a professional climber, that this would be the way in which I made my living, but I followed what I really love to do. And that has led me to over 50 different countries around the world and all of these incredible people that I've gotten to meet and experience along the way. And that's been a very powerful aspect to my experience in life thus far, is just the, learning about what it takes to go after your wildest dreams.
Well, you certainly have done that and are still doing it. So congrats and continued success.
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much to Sasha, the world champion climber, three-time U.S. national champion, and as you heard, CEO of Senbars, a superfood nutrition bar company. So she's got a lot going on. Make sure you support and get her book, Take the Lead, Hanging On, Letting Go, and Conquering Life's Hardest Climbs, wherever books are sold. Thank you for listening. Make sure to like, favorite, share, and subscribe. On behalf of show, we appreciate you.